ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hola.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. It's a big week in Victoria.
For the laws, the policies, and the decisions of this Parliament and those that came before it, laws that took land, removed children, broke families, and tried to erase culture, we say sorry.
That's Premier Jacinta Allen in the Victorian Parliament delivering a formal apology to First Nations for past injustices.
We know that words alone are not enough. This is why the state of Victoria has pursued treaty to create the enduring change that must follow.
On Friday, history will be made when Victoria's statewide treaty with Indigenous communities comes into effect. For the first time in this country, there will be a treaty between Aboriginal people and an Australian government. Lawyer Narita Waite, a Yorta Yorta Narangiri and Tungurung woman, is a member of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, which negotiated the treaty terms with the state government. She's also the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. Narita, how important is this treaty for you?
Well, look, this treaty has come after a decade of our community walking hand in hand with the Victorian government to achieve this. It's a chance for all of Victorians to acknowledge our past, heal and move forward together. And this treaty really honours that people thrive when they can set their own course in life, when they can make choices about what works best for them and their families based on their own experiences, talents and aspirations. And that basically means that decisions about us are made by us, and that'll lead to improvements in health, education and housing for our people and, you know, the practical impact on the ground. We also need the power to hold governments to its promises. As we all know, governments like to make promises, but they rarely deliver. Now, for the first time, Aboriginal communities will have the power to hold them accountable to these promises and delivering real outcomes for First Peoples through the evolution of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria. We're upgrading community infrastructure. We're having more First Peoples place names and celebrating and sharing our culture and building our knowledge, skills and leadership. All of these things together mean that we can have a strong path for our generations to come, which for me as a mum of two boys is incredibly important.
So the process has been a long one. It's taken 10 years to get to this point. You're a member of the First Peoples Assembly. It's made up of elected members and also traditional owners. How many members are there in the First Peoples Assembly?
Yeah, so there's 37 right now. So the regions are split up between metropolitan, southeast, southwest, northeast and northwest. Assembly members hold their position for 3 years, and their role includes obviously aspects of engagement, cultural governance, facilitating community, engaging in chamber meetings and papers and really doing that cultural practice of law and law.
So the treaty between the Victorian government and the state's First Peoples was signed on November the 13th by the Premier Jacinta Allen and the First Peoples Assembly co-chairs Ruben Berg and Ngara Murray. But on the same day, the state government announced its intention to pass laws that will see children as young as 14 face adult jail time for certain violent crimes. And Narita, given the over-incarceration of Indigenous people, both adults and young people, you've described the new laws as cruel and at odds with the sentiment of the treaty. Why?
It was a very incredibly tense environment for us all, because here we were celebrating this historic next step in the treaty pathway, one that would give hope to our generations and particularly our young people. And here was the government who just announced that those young people would be better off in cells than out there in community, having a chance at rehabilitation, having a chance at a future, having hope. That is why, for me, it is at complete odds with the treaty and the aspiration that it sets out. And I would draw people's attention to particularly the preamble, which talks about the historic wrongs and the contemporaneous injustices of our people. The laws are certainly another instance of injustice.
Narita, does this suggest that whatever the consultation mechanisms in the treaty, they're not going to stop laws like this from going forward in the future, even if the First Peoples Assembly voices its opposition or makes arguments against them because you would argue that they're not in the best interests of First Nations Victorians?
Certainly, it's not a guarantee to stop bad laws and bad decision making, but it does put up a few more roadblocks. And the way it does that is that now, just like any time a bill comes before Parliament and a statement of compatibility has to be produced.
For people outside Victoria, that's a statement of compatibility with the Charter of Rights and Responsibilities, which is kind of like a human rights instrument that we have here in Victoria.
And that similarly exists in the ACT and Queensland. Those types of processes will now have to be done in relation to treaty. So whenever a bill is being put to Parliament, there will have to be advice about whether or not that bill is compatible with Victoria's statewide treaty. I think that is incredibly important because it makes sure that every parliamentarian knows before they're considering a bill and where their vote may lay what it means, not only in relation to human rights, but also now what it means in relation to treaty and the commitments that the Victorian government has made on behalf of the state. Also, as part of the statewide treaty, the elected forum or the First People's Assembly of Victoria has the power to make representations to government. There's also a positive duty to consult at the earliest stage. So not suddenly the night before a bill is announced or an intention is announced, but at those earlier stages of policy formation and thinking, there will also be the ability to hold government to its account through Nyingma Nanyawara so that when they make decisions like these, which will mean that they backtrack on progress made on targets 10 and 11 of the National Closing the Gap Agreement, which relate to both adult and youth imprisonment, we can put them firmly in the hot seat about the decisions that they've made and what it means for Aboriginal young people.
So it sounds like, yes, there will be an opportunity to talk things through, to be consulted, to put the views of the First People's Assembly to the Parliament, but ultimately it could ultimately not change anything, not change an outcome.
No, there's no guarantee, and I think this exists in most spaces, that you can positively change Parliament's mind. And if you did, that would be rather problematic, I would think. I think what this does mean is at least our viewpoints can't be ignored. We can't be ignored. And the evidence base of what works can't be ignored. And then governments can't hide behind phrases such as unintended consequences because they were told, they're aware, they chose to proceed. Any consequences that flow from that are intended.
You see the treaty and the treaty processes, these forms of consultation which will take place, as a positive?
I do. I see it as a way that Aboriginal people have an engagement in political life of the state. I also see it, particularly noting that the First People's Assembly of Victoria will have the ability to make substantive rules in relation to matters like cultural water flows and confidential Aboriginality, a way whether, you know, in future when ongoing treaties may be negotiated, there might be an ability for them to have substantive rulemaking power in relation to other areas of life that our people suffer very poor consequences.
And you're talking there about possible, we have a statewide treaty, but there might also be treaties with traditional owners at a kind of a more regional or local level. And there's also, of course, the opportunity for the statewide treaty to evolve over time. So you're kind of alluding to all of those possibilities. So the big issues for you would be what? Law and order, child protection, health. They're the big areas where you really want the treaty processes to kick in and put the agenda of First Nations people in Victoria, putting that forward front and centre.
Yes, and I think, you know, other areas like housing are also incredibly important because, you know, they are often a determinant of safety and success. But I would also like to see treaty evolve to a position of supporting Aboriginal communities' place and contributions to the Victorian economy, because I think that is really important and a pathway to ensure that we are seen as an important part of Victorian society, but also as people like anyone who want to make positive contributions and have a lot to offer, whether it's our culture, whether it's expressions of our art, whether it is the businesses and the opportunities that we create.
Narita Waite, a Yorta Yorta Naranjeri and Tangarong woman and a member of the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria and also CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, VALS. Thank you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you so much.
Associate Professor Harry Hobbs is an expert on treaty making at the University of New South Wales. And Melbourne barrister Tim Goodwin, a member of the Yuin Nation, is one of the barristers who advised the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria on treaty negotiations. Welcome both of you to the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Tim, if I can start with you, how significant is this treaty for you personally as an Indigenous man and also wearing your hat as a barrister? How legally significant is it?
It's hugely significant to me as an Aboriginal person, as a member of the Yuin people and as a lawyer, because it is the first modern day treaty in Australia built, designed and negotiated by First Peoples through a representative body that they themselves designed, which I think is a significantly important element of this process. And it's inspiring. The thought that has gone into building the outcome of the treaty, Galangwal, through the treaty itself and through the Statewide Treaty Act is really creative on a number of levels legally, but also really important when we come to thinking about how First Peoples can properly self-determine their futures and build a renewed relationship with government.
Well, let's come back to how they build that self-determination through this structure in a moment. Harry, as a settler Australian, what does this treaty mean for you? How significant is it both personally and as a lawyer?
I think it's incredibly significant as well. I echo what Tim has just said. A treaty process is between two parties, right? It's between Indigenous peoples on one side and Australian governments on the other side. Australian governments obviously represent all peoples in Australia, be they Indigenous or not, but this is very significant. When the British arrived here in the 1780s, they chose not to negotiate their presence when they first arrived. This was very different from what they had done in North America and what they had done in New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand. The reasons why they did this can be speculated, but it is a continuing failure, right? Or it has been a continuing failure over many generations for non-Indigenous Australians to try to come to terms with the presence of a people who had been here for more than 60,000 years and try to work out ways to live together, to share the land, share governance together. And I think as a non-Indigenous Australian, I think this is a really inspiring, belated act of nation building, really, right? The treaty is a way that we can learn to live together and work well in partnership. And so for me personally, it's incredibly significant. But I think for Australia, for all Australians, it's very significant.
Tim, if I can come back to you, what are the three public institutions that this treaty creates? There's a new authority called the Galangwal, which means tip of the spear or pointed spear in the Gunai Kurnai language. What are the three arms of this? We spoke to Narita from the First Peoples Assembly. That's the first body, isn't it?
Yeah, so Galangwal is the overarching body and it has three elements to it. So first you have the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria, which is the representative and deliberative body of Galangwal. So it's made up of representatives of First Peoples from across Victoria, focused on traditional owners. And it is the body that has particular deliberative powers, such as rulemaking for the purposes of First Peoples in Victoria, to make representations to government, to involve itself in policy debates and provide guidance to both government and the non-government sector on issues pertaining to First Peoples in Victoria.
Can I just clarify? So it will, the First Peoples Assembly or its representatives will speak to Parliament, speak to Cabinet, speak to, I think, the Police Commissioner about issues of concern to Indigenous Victorians, and it has that right to do so.
Yes, and so there are some institutional structures established by the Statewide Treaty Act that allow for that to happen, that allow for representation functions to Parliament, that allow for participation in Cabinet meetings throughout the year, and that allow it to engage directly with the heads of government departments and the Police Commissioner on issues relevant to First Peoples. Then you have an Office of Truth-Telling and Healing, which continues the important work of the Yuruk Justice Commission, the Truth-Telling Royal Commission that reported in June this year. Clearly, the work of truth-telling in Victoria is not ended. There are so many important truths to be told, and importantly, in terms of building on the work of Yuruk around what might be done to alleviate the systemic disadvantage and injustice that has historically occurred in Victoria.
So that kind of truth-telling arm, the Nayona Yuruk Telkuna, is its task to what? Dialogue with the Indigenous community to talk about the ongoing impacts of colonisation and then communicate those back to the broader public?
Yeah, exactly. So it's about providing a space to be able to assist us understand the truth of our history here in Victoria.
And then there's a third body, the Nyingma Nenga Wara, which is translated as "you will do."
So the third arm's focus is on monitoring and accountability, particularly monitoring government performance against its commitments in relation to First Peoples. It's always been an aspiration of First Peoples to have structural capacity to monitor government performance and to hold government accountable to the promises it makes in relation to First Peoples. We know First Peoples in Victoria and across the country are the most disadvantaged group on a majority, if not all, socioeconomic indicators. So holding government accountable in relation to the various policy commitments it makes is centrally important for First Peoples in circumstances where the litany of government failure in Indigenous policy is legendary.
What does that look like, that monitoring? It means the right to ask for information and data from, from criminal justice authorities, from education department, from the health department. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So it's about data collection, it's research, it's policy development. It's a majority of those things that can be able to be harnessed to not only hold a government accountable, but this is an element of the design feature of Gelengwaal. It's also to be able to assist the First Peoples Assembly element of Gelengwaal to advocate for change in policy, to build the evidence base about what works in Indigenous policy to better some of those socioeconomic metrics. So that's an element of the design feature of Gelengwaal, that these three elements of the body speak to each other, that their capacity is harnessed by each other for the purposes of building the capacity of First Peoples to self-determine their own futures, but also to assist government to do the work that it needs to do for First Peoples.
So basically, what is commencing on December the 12th in Victoria is these kinds of structures and these kinds of relationships between those structures and government. This treaty doesn't involve a kind of transfer of land or resources or anything like that. It's about setting up these frameworks. Harry, there are different ways of thinking about where we've arrived in Victoria. What are those different ways of looking at the current situation or what's been achieved?
That's right. So as you said, and as Tim laid out, it's a very much an institutional, iterative, interactional type agreement. It sets up the structures for a new relationship going forward and tries to ensure that First Peoples will have a say in decisions that affect them, and it also can monitor what government is doing when it says that it's going to do X, Y, and Z in relation to First Peoples affairs. This is taking 10 years to get to this stage. If you trust the process, if you think the negotiations have worked effectively, if you think that the relationships that have been built between First Peoples and government, not just in cabinet, but also in the departments, in the police commissioner's office, all this sort of stuff, if you think those relationships are building, then you might have a lot of faith in the process and you think that this will lead to further and better agreements as you go forward. The agreement itself doesn't relate to transfer of land, doesn't recognise significant domains of rulemaking power or anything like that. It's very much advisory bodies. But at this stage, I guess if you think the process is working and you think it is going well, it sets the scene for a different relationship going forward. That's my view. I want it to succeed. I think it's very positive. I understand it is preliminary, but I think it is very positive and it sets up a pathway forward that we haven't ever done before. But at the same time, you could look at it and say, well, we've spent 10 years of preliminary negotiations and discussions and we've ultimately led to or got to a situation where we have what you could quite frankly describe as just good governance issues. So you said, well, if we're going to make laws about people, we should get those people in the room and ask them if the laws are going to work. If we're going to try and understand how governance should operate in Australia or in Victoria, we should probably have an understanding of the history of Victoria and see how previous laws and policies have affected particular peoples. And if we promise to do something, we should probably have a way to work out whether we're actually effectively doing what we said we'll do. All of these things are good, but they don't necessarily need to be done via a treaty process, right? They could be done just ordinarily as part of the practice of government. So if you don't think the process is going to work, or if you look at the history of Indigenous state relations in Australia, particularly around treaty processes, if you look to the Victorian opposition that said that they'll scrap the treaty if they secure election next year, you might say that we spent 10 years and we haven't got very far. I don't hold that view. I understand that view. I do think that the process is working, but it does come down to political will, right? I think one of the most significant things of the agreement is not so much the legal architecture, which is significant, it is the political significance of proving that this is possible and saying that treaties are not divisive, they're not dangerous, they're not radical, they can be accommodated within our public law system. And that is a good lesson worth learning, because a lot of the debate over generations in Australia has been around whether it's even possible to negotiate a treaty. This statewide treaty proves it is, and we can make more and better ones as we go forward.
Yes, there's recognition, and this is requiring government to listen, but it's not requiring government to act. So, Tim, legislation, for instance, which would treat 14-year-olds as adults for the purposes of sentencing for a number of crimes, which Indigenous Victorians say is going to impact disproportionately on young Indigenous Victorians. Okay, the research can be done by the Nyingma Nyingawara. That information can be fed back to the First Peoples Assembly. The state government can nod its head and say, we are interested, we hear you, and then it can do what it wants. That's a reality here.
Yeah, absolutely. But like Harry was saying, what the important significance of the creation of Gelengwaal through the treaty process is that you have political institutions that are able to be owned and representative of First Peoples, who can make direct representation to government on those issues without invitation. And that's a critical feature of the outcome of this treaty, that Indigenous peoples in Victoria and across the nation have been shut out of the rooms where these decisions are made. And so the importance of that access, that a number of groups in civil society and across government have by the stroke of a pen or a text message, you suddenly have institutional structures that allow Indigenous people to be in those rooms. Also, a significant feature is empowering Indigenous communities themselves to advocate for and be the political designers of solutions to First Peoples issues. So you're actually building the capacity of Indigenous peoples themselves to advocate and to be participants in the political process. Now, like any participant in the political process, it is ultimately up to the executive and parliament to determine what it might do within the scope of its constitutional powers. But the building of political self-determination and self-constitution itself for First Peoples is an important step that this treaty process allows through the creation of Gelengwaal, or at least sets up a process for that to build, so that Indigenous political power, which is ancient in nature, is redeveloped, evolves, and itself allows for the development of political processes and of political power.
So we had the failed referendum in 2023 for a voice to federal parliament. That was rejected by a majority of voters in Australia. We also had, going back, ATSIC, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission. Towards the end of its life, it became discredited in the eyes of many Australians. Victoria's now had 10 years of thought and negotiation into creating the three bodies that we've been talking about, and to build credibility with First Peoples communities, but also build credibility with the broader community. So is the goal to have the trust going both ways?
Yeah, exactly. And a number of the design features of Gelong Wahl have learnt from both of those events or processes that you've just mentioned. So ATSIC existed for 20 years and achieved some really important and powerful things in that time, and really became a political football towards the end of its tenure. But a lot of people forget that ATSIC had the dual role of service delivery in terms of being a bureaucratic model, as well as policy development, and so had to use its funding to do both. And inevitably, that means that policy development is put to the bottom of the list in favour of service delivery, given the need in Indigenous community. And ATSIC, after a decision was made very early in its tenure that it would not be responsible for health or education, meant that it only ever controlled 15% of expenditure in Indigenous affairs, but got blamed for 85% of the problems that were occurring in Indigenous affairs. So Gelong Wahl has design features that have learned from that process. It is not a service delivery model. Gelong Wahl understands that the best models of service delivery are community-controlled organisations on the ground, operated by community, well-funded by government and civil society. That's the model that works for Indigenous people. So Gelong Wahl avoids that problem. And also it puts the meat on the bones in relation to what was discussed in relation to the voice and the referendum, and establishes it in legislation so that it can start to get runs on the board for the purposes of building legitimacy and credibility amongst not only the First Peoples community, but the general Victorian community.
And Harry, very briefly, the rest of Australia is looking on?
I hope so. Yeah, I think I agree with Tim's point just to say there that, you know, you say how will we measure the success of this organisation? Other jurisdictions across Australia will look to see whether it's working. I would just say that we've had a closing the gap strategy for more than 20 years now and it hasn't worked, and so it's worth trying something different. Why don't we talk to First Peoples and ask them if they have some ideas about how to re-empower their communities, revitalise their laws, allow them to have a greater recognition of their rights and status within the country, right? Let's may as well try something different. All the evidence around the world says that when you recognise the self-determining powers of First Peoples, socioeconomic indicators improve. This is research from the United States over 30, 40 years and Canada, where they say that communities that sign modern treaties end up with improved socioeconomic outcomes. That means that the communities themselves are better. That also means that the state spends less money on welfare and other policies like that, right? So it's a win-win in my book in the economic sense. It's a win-win in the political, cultural sense. It gives me a stronger sense of Australian identity. I think the rest of Australia should be watching.
University of New South Wales Associate Professor Harry Hobbs, expert on treaty making, and Melbourne barrister Tim Goodwin, member of the UN Nation and one of the barristers who advised the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria on treaty negotiations. Thanks both for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you very much.
With developments in Victoria, Australia is taking a first and tentative step into the world of treaties. Treaties with First Peoples take different forms in different settler countries. For instance, in New Zealand, the 1840 Treaty of Waitangi, which was signed by 500 Maori chiefs and the British Crown, is considered the country's founding document. In contrast, in Canada, there are many treaties, mostly between individual First Nations and mostly provincial governments. Constitutional law expert Emeritus Professor Jeremy Weber is based at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Jeremy, how many treaties are there with First Nations people in Canada?
There are many, many, because the treaty processes in Canada really began with the British conquest back in 1760. The first treaties occurred then, and then there were successive waves of treaty making that occurred later on. There was, though, the 50-year hiatus that occurred from the early 1920s to the mid-1970s. And so what usually does in Canada is one divides the contemporary treaties, the treaties beginning with the James Bay Northern Quebec Agreement in 1975, from the historic treaties that occurred prior to 1921.
So you have two tranches of treaties, or two types of treaties. Are they, generally speaking, between individual First Nations and provincial governments as opposed to with the entire Indigenous population of a particular province?
There's quite a variation. The contemporary treaties tend to be with individual First Nations, but even there, there are sometimes, for example, in the Yukon, there was an umbrella agreement that was determined first with multiple First Nations, and then each individual First Nation had its own variation upon that umbrella agreement. If you go back into the historic treaties, the numbered treaties, for example, that essentially covered the Canadian prairies, they were often with more than one First Nation.
And what did these agreements cover? What sorts of things did they cover? Are they about land ownership and land control?
So the contemporary ones have been about dealing with primarily with land ownership. And what they've tended to do is to allocate to the First Nation a portion of the traditional territory in what amounts to full ownership, but then provides more restricted rights over the balance of the territory. There's also, almost certainly in the contemporary treaties, always self-government arrangements that are also put in place by the treaty.
When you mean self-government arrangements, do you mean policing, education, restorative justice over particular geographic areas?
Yes, those kinds of things. In fact, one of the treaties, the treaty that it provided for the establishment of the new Inuit majority territory in northern Canada. So in fact, it actually laid the foundation for establishing a completely new territorial government, a public government of which all residents of the territory participate in. But usually the contemporary treaties have dealt with rights to handle a number of the internal affairs of the First Nation by its own authority. Also, almost always, participation in the making of land use decisions with respect to the balance of the territory. So a measure of co-management of the territory that is shared between the First Nation and the non-Indigenous population.
And are they final settlements, or are they mechanisms which allow ongoing dialogue between government and First Peoples?
Well, so they've tended to be conceived of as being final settlements from the non-Indigenous side, beginning from the later historical treaties through the contemporary treaties. The essential idea was to put in place a final settlement of Indigenous entitlement to the land, Indigenous arrangements for governance, and so on. But what has become clear within the Canadian context is that that is a really difficult ask. It puts huge pressure on the negotiations. If you're representing a First Nation, if you're a leader of a First Nation, you really face the prospect of perhaps making a historical error for your people that your people will live with forever. And on the other side, there's just so many considerations that are involved that often from the non-Indigenous side, too, the negotiations essentially get bogged down in just the excruciating detail. And there's really been a recognition in Canada in the practice of engagement that really Indigenous peoples aren't going anywhere. This is really going to be a continuing partnership, and it's really to arrange the terms of those partnership. And so there's been quite a move in Canada to really, instead of trying to make final settlements, instead deal with things issue by issue, perhaps not even call them treaties. In fact, the most recent agreements, very important agreements, have not even been termed treaties. So there's really been a move away from the sense that this has to be a final settlement towards a more progressive, continual structuring of a relationship.
Jeremy, have you followed what's been taking place in Victoria? Here, the new treaty is really about creating an architecture for ongoing dialogue rather than transferring power or recognising power or transferring resources in a way you've been describing in Canada. Is that something that you've been paying attention to and perhaps people in Canada have been paying attention to?
Those people who work in this area have been paying attention to it. And this idea of structuring the relationship going forward is something that has also become common in the Canadian context. I think it's also fair to say that in the Canadian context, the agreements that now have in large measure taken the place of treaties nevertheless deal with substantive issues, control over the land, who has title to the land, how the land is going to be managed, Those kinds of things are dealt with in agreements, arrangements in different areas of government activity. Those things are treated in what I guess they're not called treaties now. That carries constitutional consequences in the Canadian context. There really has tended to be a move towards a progressive working out of this relationship and a recognition of rights that Indigenous peoples have to govern the land. But unlike, I guess, the Victorian provisions, it doesn't just deal with structures of representation. Most of the agreements in the Canadian context also accomplish substantive changes. And I should say that's not to criticize the Victorian arrangements. Really, the recognition of the authority to interact, the willingness to interact and to address the challenges together through discussion, that's a hugely important step, and a step that has not come easily in Canada, even though our form of our agreements are somewhat different.
Emeritus Professor Jeremy Weber, a constitutional expert based at the University of Victoria in Canada, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
A pleasure.
That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. Now, next week we start our summer season. You'll hear some of our favourite programs from 2025. So I hope you have a wonderful summer break. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and to audio producer this week, Ross Richardson. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.